Welcome to The Hidden World of Women, a podcast brought to you by Women's Health and Wellbeing Services. My name is Emma and I'll be your host for today's episode. International Women's Day is this week, it's Friday, and I acknowledge that we still do have a way to go, but I normally try and mark International Women's Day by celebrating actually just how far we have come. This year, I was struggling to think about how to highlight International Women's Day for the podcast. And then I happened to see a post about the passing of, I hope I pronounce this correctly, the passing of Iris Apfel at aged 102. An acquaintance acknowledged her joy of life as being infectious and then in the post went on to call her one of her sheroes. And I will admit I had a bit of a physical reaction to that term. And in that moment I thought, oh, I've got a topic for the podcast. So... terms like shiro, CEO, mumpreneur, girl boss, what are these terms actually doing for women? So to discuss this, I'm joined by an absolutely amazing woman, Lacey Filipich. Lacey is oh so many things to oh so many people. Lacey is a chemical engineer. She's an international award-winning financial literacy educator. That is a mouthful. She's an author of some very serious books and some beautiful children's books, children's stories, and she's been a serial entrepreneur since the age of 10. She's a wife and a mum to two young people, and her love of startups is matched by her love of sci-fi. Her go-to karaoke song is Baby Got Back. Thank you so much for joining me today, Lacey.
Thanks so much for having me, Emma. I'm delighted to be here.
So before we kick into the CEO and Shiro, are you doing anything to celebrate International Women's Day? Let me guess, you're baking some cupcakes.
Funnily enough, I'm not making cupcakes. No, I've actually got four events to get to on Friday. And because the topic this year is heavily financially focused, I've had lots of wonderful requests. So I get to speak at the WA Department of Finance. Then I'm off to UN Women Australia. Then I'm off to Hastings Technology Medals. And then I finish the day by mentoring some high school students at the Equal Opportunity Commission. So that's my favorite. I've been doing that for 5 years now.
Yeah.
At the end of International Women's Day, I go and meet a bunch of, we do like speed dating with these year 11 and 12 girls. And they're usually from marginalized communities. It's probably... I love speaking. It's wonderful fun, but that's probably my favourite part of International Women's Day. So I'm always grateful when the Equal Opportunity Commission invites me back.
Oh, this sounds amazing. So with all of that, and you have been an entrepreneur since the age of 10, which was about, 10 years ago.
Thanks, Emma.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about terms like shiro, CEO, girl boss?
Yeah, I had to think about this deeply recently when the term girl maths popped up, and that's actually what got me thinking about it, because I, like you, have an almost visceral reaction when I hear, for example, CEO.
Yeah,
I shudder. I literally go, oh God, do we really need to? And I always think of it as it's this double-edged sword. So first of all, we want to see these amazing people do these incredible things so that little girls and young women everywhere go, yeah, I can do that. You know, it's that if you can see her, you can be her theory, which I adore. So I get why we try to come up with catchy titles and catchy names and we try to get people to identify with it. So I understand the good it's trying to do. I think that's what it's mostly about. But I just feel that if you don't use the male equivalent, if you wouldn't call him a he-eo or, you know, I know hero, that's already got here. But you know what I mean. If you don't.
You wouldn't call him a man boss or a boy boss, would you? You certainly wouldn't call him a boy boss. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. And so I feel like the moment you apply those kinds of labels, so first of all, you're labeling them as other.
Yeah.
Often they trivialize what you're trying to do, like girl boss particular. I'm like, oh, that is. You know, and look, I get that the business name is, it's been deliberate, but business chicks, I can't look at that name not shudder. And I've been looking at it for like 5 years. You'd think it'd wear off by now. So like, and then you would never say, I don't know what the equivalent of a chick is for a man, but you wouldn't have business
bros.
Well, most people wouldn't want to join that. They'd be So I think, does it do more harm than good?
Mm.
Now, that's how I think about it.
Mm.
I think it does more harm than good. I think on net, it reinforces this idea that women are other and that what they do is other. And I always, you know, I think if you're going to test it, reverse it. You know, if the reverse isn't true, if you wouldn't do it, which we wouldn't, I can't imagine anyone being called a boy boss.
Yeah, no.
Or anyone even thinking of using that term, then there's a chance that what you're doing is not going to be helpful. And so while I understand and I applaud what they're trying to achieve, I think people maybe haven't realized the possible negatives of what they're doing.
Yeah, and look, I totally agree with all of those points. And I think it is difficult. And I've shared on the podcast before that when I became a CEO, quite, you know, what is it, 17 years ago, there were very few female CEOs to have as role models or mentors. And it was difficult. The mentors that I was able to reach out to, they were males, and a female CEO cannot behave in the same way that a male CEO does. Like, it's just, well, it doesn't work the same. It just doesn't work the same way.
Double standards, right?
It's total double standards. And I think we need to create a space where women can actually lean into the skills that women have without having to try and emulate males. So I kind of understand the idea of having this CEO, because there needs to be a space carved out for women. But by highlighting it, does it actually say, well, there isn't a space for women, so we're going to make you a special little space over here that you can sit in, because you don't get to sit with the big boys at the big boy table. You can sit over there with everybody else wearing a skirt.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I echo – that really resonates with me. You're exactly right. And whenever I hear people say, well, if you haven't got a seat at the table, we'll build your own table. Look, that might be the only option that's available to you, but it's not going to fix the gaps, the gender gaps that we have. The only way we fix that is make the table accessible.
That's exactly it. Tell them to shove over and pull another chair in.
Exactly. And then they recognize that, hey, we need both types or multiple, you know, perspectives around the table, and that will make the table a better place for everybody. That's got to be the end goal. So do we have to go via create a separate table or a separate space to get there? I'm not sure. I'm not sure that you have to. I'm not sure that it's the best way to go about it. I mean,
yeah,
I don't sliding doors.
But what message is that sending to people that, well, if you can't find a space at that table, then build your own? Why should I have to?
Exactly. Why should you have to? You shouldn't have to do something separate. You should be included.
Yeah.
And that's this difference between diversity and inclusion. Like, oh, we achieve diversity by having the women's group over here or the women's panel or this, you know, special sort of separate thing. But inclusion has to be the end goal where we're all in it together. So, yeah, that's where I get really up in arms about this. And I remember with the girl maths, that really, like, I was going, my first reaction was I can't stand that term because it is being used to trivialize and ridicule. Now, that said, there was a lot of joking about it and the women were making fun of it, and it was, you know, tongue in cheek, lots of jest. So I did appreciate that. And there was lots of, you know, giggling around. Oh, well, you know, I bought the handbag for, you know, $500, but that's only less than $1 a day.
100%. When I'm explaining to my husband why I needed the eternity ring after 1 year of marriage and not 10, girl math all the way.
Exactly. So I get it. And it is funny and it's good. But, you know, the two researchers that I talked to, Dr. Tracy West and Dr. Ilva Bakstrom, so one's Talk Money. I don't know if you've seen them from Extra Foundation. Extra Foundation have that fantastic student program. And Dr. Ilva Bakstrom is in the UK at and I think it's King's College she teaches at. She's a senior finance lecturer. And both of them were like, no, Lacey, this is an opportunity for women to finally feel included.
Yeah.
They finally relate to it. And given that girls tend to, according to the research, decide quite early, like primary school age, that they're not good at maths. And even though it's not really true, we do connect maths and money together. Mm. And I sort of was like, well, if I'm being pragmatic, you know, like, yes, it offends me. I don't like it.
Yeah.
But if I'm being pragmatic and this is the only way that I'm going to get little girls to go, well, I can do math.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore I can do money, like the means to an end part of it. Do I go, fine, use that saying, you know, like, so that really made me think about whether I'm causing, you know, people to feel excluded just by saying don't use it. So I'm conscious that you've got to have so many different options, right? There's no like absolute here. But I do worry that any of those girls might come out and go, oh, well, I can only do girl math. Or
yeah,
like, that's
exactly
the only thing I'm interested in. So, like, yeah, so I don't know. It's so messy, this stuff. Emma,
it's
I
wish it was simple. It's so difficult, isn't it?
yes.
And I want to go into that, but just before I just will share, I was photographing an event and it was a very big deal with some very high-powered people. I'll tell you what it is when we're not recording. But they had – and it's a – particular thing where they're aiming for 50% of representation being female. So,
awesome.
Yeah, awesome. And then they split off into, so everyone came together for, you know, most of it, and then they split off into different groups to have different conversations. And I went to go and photograph the a room that was being run by two incredible women who are two of the most well-educated people that I have ever had the pleasure of meeting. Beautiful women, incredibly intelligent, incredibly well-spoken. And I went into their room and it was all pink, and they'd put up like a pink sparkle sequin backdrop with props so that you could have like a photo wall, and they had aromatherapy going and pink streamers. The only thing I did appreciate was they did have more lollies in their room than anywhere else. But I was like, what have I just walked into? And this was what they'd done to make women feel more comfortable. And,
wow.
And I think, oh, that's what I need to make me feel more comfortable, make me feel like my thoughts and my voice can be heard. I need a photo prop wall.
And a pink sparkly one.
A pink sparkly one. And some aromatherapy oils.
Yeah.
It was horrendous. Yeah. And then I went to, you know, some of the other panels that were being run by the men, and funnily enough, they didn't have those things there.
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? It's so well intentioned, isn't it? Mm. We're trying, we're really trying. We're trying to make you comfortable, but we've just missed the mark. You know, it really reminds me of, there was this great example, I pull it out regularly. So Vic Super, 6 years ago, I will add, ran this, oh, nearly seven, actually, I should say. I think it was 2017. Oh, my gosh, we're in 2024. Anyway, 7 years ago. They ran this program called the Superwoman Money Program, and their goal was to help women become better financially equipped so they could have great retirements. And they published 315 tips, and one of them was like, reuse your tea bags.
Oh, my God.
I know, but stuff like that throughout it, you know, it was all of this like well-intentioned, but basically saying, you go without, ladies. Yeah. That's how you get ahead financially. We're not going to, you know, pay you more commensurately. Mm. We're not going to, you know, get rid of the motherhood penalty. We're not going to make you feel safe everywhere. We're not going to make you feel included. We're going to put the responsibility back on you. You go without, woman. Mm. And so, they really, like, you could see, you can imagine the brainstorming group. There was probably women in that brainstorming group. There were probably people writing that were female. And they thought with the best of intentions,
yeah,
that this was going to help. Whereas I hold that up as an example of what not to do. Like, do not tell people to go with that. And I, you know, it sounds like you might be a bit like me, Emma. If I walked into a room that was all pink and sparkles, I'd like, ugh, back away slowly. It's not my scene.
100%. If, you know, I'm like, going to a Barbie movie party, yes, maybe, yeah. But yeah,
yeah.
So you're gonna Barbie movie party,
yeah. But it's exactly, it's like a visual metaphor for this othering, isn't it?
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Well, that's the girl boss room. Off, yeah, you go, girl bosses. You know, yeah, like, you. It's actually kind of a perfect metaphor for, mm-hmm, the impact of using these words. They have this great intention, but then they just separate.
Yeah.
They don't include, which misses the point of the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, that's
I can
exactly
just imagine
it
in your face.
Oh, luckily I was holding a camera, so I hid most of it behind the camera. But there aren't many photos of that room. So.
Oh, my gosh, I can imagine.
With that idea around the best of intentions for inclusion, I actually really struggle with so I have two daughters, and I've struggled their whole education around the idea of trying to promote girls in STEM. And I'll share why, because obviously I think that STEM is a place where everybody should be welcome, regardless of gender. And my concern is the more emphasis we put on trying to create space for girls in STEM, the more we actually highlight the fact that STEM isn't a place where girls normally are. And so, I understand that if we don't do things to encourage girls into STEM, then we do end up in the situation that you were speaking about, where girls think, oh, maths isn't for me, science isn't for me, you know, tech certainly isn't for me. I actually don't know how to turn my television on, so tech definitely isn't for me. But I love maths. So, you know, kind of, I understand the concept of trying to increase awareness, and if you can see her, you can be her, and I love that. But I struggle with this idea around girls in STEM, and is that potentially having the opposite impact to what we're hoping for? So have you got any thoughts?
Oh, do I have thoughts on this, Emma? I have I've reflected on my personal experience, and of course through women in technology I've been exposed to so many other stories, you know, because I had a pretty lucky experience with all this stuff. I kind of agree with you. If I had been told about how few women there were in engineering, would I have signed up?
Yeah, exactly.
If I'd known about that. And it is this almost disingenuous thing that we do to students, you know, like my class of chemical engineering was half male, half female.
Yeah.
50 students, 25 women, 25 men.
What was like, it when you finished?
It was that.
Oh,
was
you finished? Oh, wow. Yeah.
So what happened with engineering, there's multiple types of engineering, and you did a first year that was a common first year, and it was about 500 students and about 15% of them were women. So not, you know, less than one in five. And then you pick your discipline. So you're picking between electrical and mechanical and civil, and, you know, there's 11 choices at the university I went to, and I didn't like 10 of them, and chemical was the one I was like, I'll try that one because that's the only one I don't know I don't like. Anyway, just by luck, chemical engineering turned out to be half male, half female. A whole heap of the women ended up in there. But my friends who were in electrical engineering, you know, they were like one of five women in 100, you know, or mechanical was not too dissimilar. Turns out chemical engineering is quite heavily female oriented. So went through university, think that was normal. Then I get out into the workplace and there's not a single female superintendent.
Yeah.
That is in operations, you know, there's always HR and that kind of stuff. But in the technical fields, there was not a single female manager for me to look at the site that I went to. And it was just, I was one of like 10 women on site out of 300 people.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy heck, what have I signed up for? Like, it hadn't occurred to me.
And what do they know that I don't know?
Exactly. I spent like the 3 years of my chemical engineering specialty, so three of the 4 years of engineering, with surrounded by women.
Yeah.
You know, I had female lecturers, I had female mentors, I had female tutors. I'd like, where are they all? And that is the issue. You can do the study, we're technically proficient, we can pass these things. You put us in these workplaces where we feel unwelcome or unsafe and we leave.
Yeah.
And that's the bit that I think we are still missing. You can train as many as you like, and we know that women are more qualified on average these days. More women are doing these things, but a lot of them do leave the industry. They leave it for a variety of reasons. It's common to leave, particularly, you know, I'd ended up in mining. Not a lot of people want to stay FIFO after they have kids.
Yeah.
You know, and that is not because they don't want to do FIFO. It's because society places these enormous expectations on them. You know, the women that I know that had children went back to FIFO. Every swing, every single bloody swing, at least someone would go, oh, who's looking after your kids? And I'd be like, did you ask any of the men here?
Yeah.
None of them did. Mm. It's not a case of they don't want to do it. It's that society places these incredible expectations on them. And actually, Diane Smith Gander had a very interesting quote about this. They did some analysis following the WGEA data release on the 27th of February. Australian Financial Review published an article which had six leaders in it. And in there was Andrew Forrest. And Diane Smith Gander. And Diane Smith Gander, hero. Yeah. She was talking about how it's actually a false choice for women. We are rationally sensible human beings when it comes to money. If we thought it was going to be financially worth it, we'd do it. But we know that when we get there, like you said, a female CEO doesn't get away with the same things a male CEO gets away with. They're going to be held to a different standard. They're going to see it everywhere. And the people who can't help but ask the questions they would never ask the fathers and add this burden that the guys don't have to carry. And so I think that's the real issue. You can train them and I want them to learn. And I tell young women, study STEM. You'll earn more money. That's it. I'm there for the money. I'm like, you will earn more money. This is how come I got to be financially independent. I did engineering and then I did consulting and I made a mozza and I kept it.
Yeah.
And that's how I got to financial independence. Please study STEM. But they have to be able to persevere in these workplaces. So that first workplace where I was one of, you know, one of 10 women and 300 people on site, the next workplace I went to had a female GM. It had 3 out of their 8 managers were women and 20% of their workforce was women. So I got there and I'm like 22 at this stage and my eyes light up and I'm like, oh, this is what it can be like. There is a place like this. Oh, my gosh. And I tell you, working at that work site, I still loved the first one. I enjoyed it. But that worksite, I felt safe. I felt welcome and I wanted to stay. And until we can do that and workplaces where these women end up with their STEM qualifications, we are pushing the proverbial up an inclined slope. We will not get there. We have to have that welcomeness at the end. So I realize I've had a big rant there, but you get my point.
Oh, right? No, 100%. You enjoy the soapbox. And I think as well, there's an idea around setting quotas for how many women we want to have. I don't want to be the token woman. I don't want to be employed so that you can tick a box that says that you've got, whether you're employing me because I'm female, whether you employ me because I've got a disability, whether, you know, I want to be there because I deserve a space at the table. Don't put me there, because that way you can go, well, that's one less that we need to get. She'll probably do.
I see where you're going with this. I understand what you're saying. But this
I do understand the flip side of it as well. Yeah.
Well, we've all bought into the merit myth.
Yeah.
We've all bought in to this stupid idea that there's one perfect person for the role, that there's only one. Now, the reality is, if there was only one perfect person for the role, we would not need probationary periods. If we could pick the right person and there was only one, you wouldn't have to. There's never only one. It's always a pool. It's always a handful of people who could be fabulous in that role. And frankly, you will never know who's going to be fabulous until you've appointed them and they've been doing the role for 6 to 12 months, right? That is reality. So whenever someone says, oh, look, I do want to be there on merit, mate, if they put you in there, you were in that pool. As far as I'm concerned, you've got the merit. I understand why it doesn't feel good to be that way, but that is because we have that myth, and these other people who say that to you, those other people go, oh, yeah, but you got that because you're a woman or because you're Indigenous or because you're neurodivergent. You know, like, you got a gimme. No, I was one of the top candidates, and, yes, I bring a perspective that is different from the other people that are there, and that has a higher value, and you haven't valued it previously. As much as I understand, and I agree, like, I've railed in the past about I don't want to be the token anything.
Yeah.
You can make me the token now, mate. I'm staying. I'm going to make more room, and you are going to change.
Yeah.
And so I kind of see it as a necessary. They've had long enough without quotas and they haven't fixed it. Guess what? Now you need quotas. That's how I feel about it. Like, sort it yourself. You mucked it up. You fix it. No, you haven't fixed it. Guess what? Now you get regulation. And that's how I kind of, over this time, it's that pragmatic thing again, right? Like, I just want to achieve the outcome. We're not getting there without it. And so that's my coaching to everybody. When everyone feels like they're being a box ticker, I'm like, no, you were one of those handful. They would not have put you in that role if you couldn't do that role. You're here for a reason. It's just, yeah.
And it's funny because I actually just had that exact same conversation with somebody else, and yet I forgot to apply it to myself. But I guess I hope that we, sometime in my lifetime, that we get to a point where we're not needing to have quotas in order to have a situation where you've got 30% of your workforce being female. And actually it's just, you know, I hired you because regardless of what your gender is, I think you can do the job.
Exactly. Exactly. So what's the pathway there? And that's the thing. Yeah. When you think about the system at the moment, most of the people who are in the system have benefited from things beyond their control, you know, demographics, the ovarian lottery, you know, they've come out a certain way and that's given them a head start. So they believe, and it's a very well-researched thing, that they got there through their hard work, not through luck, whereas we know that luck has a massive contributing factor and so do your demographics. So for them to admit that that wasn't merit that got them somewhere is actually quite hard for some people, and that's why they don't necessarily want to admit it. So what's that pathway to get to that vision, which I agree, I would love to see this whole, we don't need quotas anymore. Everything is, you know, well distributed. We've changed society's beliefs enough that this is now how we run, and that anything that's not, you know, 40% female, 40% male, 20% whatever else, or whatever it is that you set as your benchmark, that one's a government one. If we're not there, then that would be seen as an anomaly.
Yeah.
But we're so far off that, and our inherent bias, I think that's the thing that's so hard to understand, and why I'd encourage everybody to take the implicit association test. Have you ever taken that test, Emma? Have you seen that one online?
No.
So Harvard's got this test, and it's called the implicit association test, IAT. And up on the screen come words, and it asks you to connect like female names with house-based tasks and male names with business tasks, and then it asks you to do the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
So like Joanne, CEO, you know.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
And it times the delay between you clicking the right buttons. So, and what it shows, there's everybody, even like I consider myself to try to be not too biased.
Yeah.
But everybody finds a bias. Everybody is slower connecting women's names with business stuff and men's names with household stuff because it's so deeply ingrained.
Yeah.
And so you're just never going to overcome that without processes and systems. We cannot just tell people to change or behave differently. You have to build it into how you do things until in maybe 100 years' time, we've changed enough to adapt. But it does take that long when it's this deeply ingrained.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be a long time before we can say, okay, you've got it all right. Big ticks, off you go.
And that's such a shame. I really do wish that we could just wave a magic wand and be where we want to be. But you're right, it is going to take time. So is that where – so you started engineering skirts?
Skirts and engineering. Yeah.
And
yeah, what a brand choice.
Perhaps if you started it now, you might come up with some different branding. Yeah,
no, I wouldn't use that name again.
Yes. So that was around engineering, you know, creating that space for women in engineering. And then there's obviously Women in Technology, WA, which is around creating that space for women in tech. Do you think that those, is there ever going to be a time when those aren't needed?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, that one. You know, and you know that Dunning-Kruger curve, which talks about your competence versus your competence, you know, so how confident you are with something versus how well you know it. And there's this initial peak, which is the peak of Mount Stupid, where you think you know what's going on.
Yeah.
And so early on, I would have probably said, oh, yes, there'll be a point one day where we don't need those things. Now, my interpretation, having seen all the stuff and coming to those realizations about what makes a safe space and the different experiences that we have, I feel like there will always need to be safe places for anyone who is marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, it's that's the irony. Any time I talk about gender, we're not a minority.
We're really not.
We're actually technically the majority.
Yeah.
But there are so many other places where this applies, like thinking of the intersectionality, you know, women of color, Indigenous women, neurospicy women, trans women, lesbian women, all those different groups that have that intersectionality. Whenever mainstream society can't cater for you or does things that naturally disadvantage you, and there's so many of those things, they're everywhere, you know, from the size of the phones that we've got to how AI is biased, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like they're always going to need a place where they can be safe from that, where they can step out and be with their peers and not have to constantly defend. So what I think is really interesting about that is it feels to me like, and I'm going to be very specific here, white, cisgender, heterosexual, neurotypical, straight men, like that category, and able-bodied, that most of society is built for them. So inherently, most of society feels like an inclusive space for them.
Yeah.
Right? So that's where I think that they kind of have their space. It's the whole world. But what we've seen is the pendulum swinging where it has to now be more inclusive for everybody else. And so they're starting to actually feel the reverse. Men are starting to feel disadvantaged. You know, I think about my husband who wouldn't apply for a job at BHP because they're positively discriminating against women. He's like, I've got no chance. Like, why would I?
Yeah.
You know, that pendulum swinging is causing it even for those men to feel they need safe spaces as well. And I guess as I've come through that, you know, learning more about it and hearing more stories and trying to read the research, which I tell you, gosh, there's a lot of research on this stuff.
Yeah, there is.
Oh my gosh, overwhelming. But I feel like almost everybody and probably even those mainstream people need a place where they can relax. And that's the point, when they don't have to be on guard.
Yeah.
They don't have to be worried about being confronted with things that are going to re-traumatize or really upset them. They can just relax. Mm. And whether that's a friendship group or whether that's a club or a society or you know, the associations that you've mentioned, I don't know, but really I think it applies to anyone who feels marginalized or excluded. So I even if we get to that point in the future, I'm wondering if, you know, everybody just wants to have somewhere where they feel like they belong easily and without all that extra energy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that I think is important for people to decompress, to be able to relate to each other, and to feel included somewhere. So I would love it if we didn't need them, but I feel like humans, we're not perfect. We're always going to need something, and probably every single group is going to need some place where they feel safe like that.
So I run a women's service, and we speak about brave spaces rather than safe spaces. So create our organisation to be a brave space, and it's a gendered service. And we feel that there's still a need for that gendered service in 2024. And similarly, I think we're still going to need it we've just celebrated our 30th birthday. I think we could be around for at least the next 30. Funding dependent. And then with my husband, we run gaming events, and 99% of the population is male. And there are times when myself and my mum and my daughters are the only women that are in the room. And so we've had that conversation with the men, saying, well, there is a need for gendered space. Do you feel that there is a need for this to be a gendered space? But for them, it's not about it being gendered. It's about it being a space where they're included, and gender doesn't come into that. So, I think all of what you're saying is kind of resonating, that actually those brave spaces, safe spaces, they're going to be required, because there's always going to be people who don't fit whatever is defined by society as normal.
Yeah, exactly. And those finding those people, you know, that's what actually brought Skirts in Engineering about.
Yeah.
There's me and my chemical engineering buddies, and we're all happy. You know, like, I've got all these female friends, and, you know, like, every group assignment I'm in is, you know, a couple of girls and a couple of boys, and it's all fabulous, yeah. Right? And there's my mates over in mechanical engineering, like, staring around the lecture theatre for the other female in the room.
God help it if she's having a day off that day.
Yeah. And I hadn't even thought about it, to be honest, because, you know, engineering's pretty intense, first of all, and you do end up, like, it's you know, 30 contact hours a week. It's an intense study. So you're not really thinking about anything else. But I was talking to a friend of mine, Kate Williamson, who was a year below me, but in mechanical engineering. She was like, yeah, there's no women. I was like, this sucks, you poor thing. Yeah. And that was where we decided that we need something else. And, of course, the girls in chemical engineering, we were all going like, well, we don't need it, but our sisters do over here.
Yeah.
And so we'll do it together. So we ended up building that one place. And, of course, when you bring 25 women from one degree, suddenly you've got a critical mass. So these poor women who'd been left, you know, by themselves or with like two or three women. And imagine if you don't get along with those two or three women, you know, like, that's the other thing that's really hard.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. It was this whole being able to have somewhere where you could be. I love that brave space, but that's such a good reframe, Emma. I'm going to try and remember that one. It was just about making sure that they had something, you know, and they needed it. We didn't feel particularly excluded, but wow, like, to hear my other friends did, I was like, that is awful. And that's the thing, you can be blind to these things and you don't see it. And it's really interesting that the gents that you were talking to, you know, they were like, well, I hadn't thought about it as gendered. I just wanted to feel included. You know, that's a bit of a privilege, but also lovely, because it's a point of, it's not about, you know, matching.
Yeah, that's it.
You're all like, hey, I'm like you. It's that they understand that it's about feeling included, and sometimes we just don't pay enough attention to how we include people.
And how we invite them to be included.
Yeah, so, well, like, take, for example, like, I've got today on my name there, you know, she, her, my pronouns. Now, I go, well, I'm clearly female, and I've always been a she, and everything's introduced as a she, so why would I need to use this? And it took a while for me to realize, hey, me using that signals to other people that it's okay, you know. And it's one of those, I just hadn't even thought about it. You know, the fact that I didn't use my pronouns regularly or introduce myself that way, I was kind of like, well, I'm leaving space for other people to do it because it's more important for them. But no, the more we can all do it, the better it is for everybody. And that kind of stuff, I think, you only learn over time as you're talking to people. And if you're interested, you have to have the time and space to learn about it. And I think that's probably been a challenge for us as a society, is we've just got too much going on. We can't allow that space to learn at the moment. And that's where I feel like we're hitting those loggerheads and we're going to need policy.
I think as well, it takes part of your character has to be able to say, I was wrong, actually. I'm prepared to have these discussions. So I'm prepared to argue with some debate rather than argue, or, you know, converse with somebody and hear the opposite side. But I'm going in that with an open enough mind that I'm okay with saying, actually, I see your point of view. I was wrong. I'm going to change. And, you know, if you look at the models of change, do you know the ADKAR model? So awareness, desire, knowledge, through all of that. You need to actually have the awareness, but you need to then have the ability to be able to do that as well.
And exactly.
I think so many people are closed-minded.
That way you engage.
Yeah.
You're willing to be curious. I know that word gets used a lot, and open to it, and those asking lots of questions. But it's naturally confrontational for people. Like, I can't imagine how hard it would be for a man to walk into a room full of women and ask, you know, what am I doing wrong? That kind of stuff would be really confronting. And there is also this thing about who we place expectation on to do the teaching. So I had this a couple of years ago where I brought up the fact that I was the only woman out of a group of nine mentors. And oh my gosh, some of the responses I got. One guy was like, "Well, I'm a husband to a wife, and I've got a daughter, and I've got two mums because my mother is gay, and I think you need to teach us, Lacey, and stop being so hard on us." And I was kind of like, "It's not my job to teach you."
Yeah.
So I think there's also this very well intentioned. Well, I want to learn, so yeah, go and learn, but don't then go to the people who are wearing that, who are currently carrying that burden to learn. So there's a bit of stuff that's not intuitive there. Like, I hadn't thought about that a lot until, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement came out, and then we had the gay marriage plebiscite. And what they found is in so many people who volunteered in those roles to try and go out to the crowds and encourage people to consider this, is that the name calling they suffered and the people who under the guise of trying to learn were actually very offensive has caused enormous amounts of post-traumatic stress. And so this idea that we're going to inflict more damage on these people by insisting that they teach us, it's now I'm very loath to, for example, ask an Indigenous person why something might be offensive to them, you know, like, or like, even well-intentioned, I try to find it myself elsewhere first. I feel like it's not fair to put more on them. And that's something as well that's only come to me through talking to people and through reading. Like, it wasn't something that was intuitive. You didn't get handed this guidebook that says, don't ask women to teach you about gender equality if you're ignorant, you know, like, that wasn't passed down. And so that whole, how do we communicate those expectations in a fair way, and how do we get there? I think we're kind of muddling through that now. That's the sense I get in society. I see more and more men being cognizant of it, being allies, standing up, making the comments first and owning those things and doing what they can. And I hope other people will take their lead over time. But it's not intuitive. I think that's the really hard bit. And how to do that well is not intuitive. So I've made like millions of mistakes, and I'll make them again this week. I know in my keynotes I'll stuff up and someone will tell me, but that's okay. I want to know and I want to do better. So
that's exactly it. And that once you know, you can do better. But
and it's that whole, do you want to be right or do you want to do the right thing? And I want to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And if that means I'm wrong some of the time and I've got to learn, I'm okay with that. I mean, I say that from a position of a high degree of confidence and financial security. So I realize that's also a privilege. You know, I can afford to be wrong.
Yeah.
Not everybody can. But I think that finding space for people to learn this way, it's very tricky waters, very tricky waters. And you can be worried about stepping up. So I think we've kind of got to equip people with those tools to be more willing to explore those things and help them. I think I've meandered well off course here possibly, but that's okay.
That's okay. Yeah. I was just thinking one of my rules for life is that I always imagine that people are doing the best that they can do. And when you know better, you can do better.
Exactly. So, that generous assumption, right? I think I heard Ben Crowe say that recently at South by Southwest. What's the most generous assumption you can make of another person's behavior? It is really good. I don't manage that every day. There are days when I assume people are against me, but
there are definitely days. I try and live by that rule. Yeah, definitely.
Exactly.
So I guess where to from here? So is the landscape actually changing? And if it is, how do we make sure? So in my opinion, terms like CEO, girl boss, they're actually sending us in the wrong direction. So how do we kind of reroute the train and get us going back in the right direction again?
I would agree. I would say directionally. So I always think about it because I love physics, you know. Is the vector
only
heading
class
in the
I've
right
ever
direction?
Failed.
Well,
actually, I dropped out before I failed, so it's okay.
But you're still at math, so you're still in my team, buddy. Oh, we're the math team. The way I think about it is always like the direction. You're going from A to B. Is the vector heading in the right direction? Good. Now, how do I improve the magnitude? Okay. So I agree with you that I think terms like CEO and girl boss and those sorts of ones are deviations. They are not heading necessarily in the right direction, or they could head off into tangents that don't help. And I think if we want to go forward quickly, then getting a consistent approach is probably going to get us there. Realistically, it's not going to happen. So don't bear ill will to people who do those things. I think they're coming from a place of good intention, but I'm not going to use your term. Yeah. And when I hear it, I'm going to go, yeah, did you use the reciprocal with the man you spoke to?
Yeah.
No? Okay, well, why? You know, and I will continue to have those conversations and make those points. So I don't bear people ill will for it. I think they could be doing more effective things. And so long as it's heading in the right direction, I'm okay with it. Now, are we heading in the right direction? Look, yes, we are at a glacial pace. So I really like, and I would recommend everyone has a look at, the Financy Women's Index. Have you ever seen the Financy Women's Index, Emma?
I have.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So they bring out a report. One came out this week just in time for International Women's Day. And Bianca Haji-Hazelman, who runs that organization, does some very interesting analysis and looks at a whole bunch of metrics. There's a lot of financial metrics in there. Things like gender retirement gaps and, you know, there is the pay equality, but there's lots of other stuff in there as well. And she does do this, like how long it's going to take us to get to equality. Now, I always think with this, like, are we going in the right direction? Is enough? Now, there's two ways to answer it. Like, one is, yeah, we're going in the right direction. We just need to do more, add more, whatever. The second thing I go is we're actually only ever 1 year away from gender equity if we really cared about it and prioritize it. Like, think about how we responded to COVID as a society. Think about how we revolutionized everything about life for like 2 years.
And we did it within a month.
Exactly. And it was an existential crisis. Yeah. If we really wanted to fix this, we could. We don't value it highly enough. We don't prioritize the spending on it. We don't prioritize the policies. And we don't make it happen quickly enough. Now, that said, there's been some amazing progress. Like when I think about the work that was done with that Respect at Work report from former Sex Discrimination Commissioner Kate Jenkins, who's, by the way, has my favorite quote on this, change does not take time. It takes action. Oh, love that woman. So that report, you know, we've seen the implementation of positive duty laws on sexual harassment in workplaces. And I've seen that literally take effect, like at a workplace. There was someone who made a sexually harassing comment that in the past might have flown under the radar. They got dismissed over it because... Now the boss has an obligation. Yeah, they have to make a safe workplace. So those policies have to happen to speed it up. And that's what I think we're missing is some very serious, ambitious policy. We are heading in the right direction. I love that we're doing the reporting. I mean, it gets called the name and change reporting, you know, the companies that need to close their individual pay gaps. All these things are going to help. And the more we can do it, the better. But I just think if we really cared, we could solve it in a year. We don't care enough. Sorry.
So how do you think we collectively, you know, you and I and people like us, how do we get it part of the agenda or what can we do? How can we make a difference? Bearing in mind, I'm really tired and I'm sick of teaching people, but you know, I'll have
a little
nap.
Well, you might actually like what I'm about to say. Okay.
Yeah.
So look, just for a bit of context before I give you my answer to that. Imagine being a financial educator who's been doing their job for 14 years and my job is to teach people how to be good about money, right? Like how to do well with money. It's individual, personal responsibility stuff, okay? Mm-hmm. Here's how to save, here's how to invest. Imagine being invited to talk at all these International Women's Day events and not mentioning a single thing about how women need to save and invest. That's what I'm doing. I want absolutely zero focus from policymakers and decision people with decision-making power on anything that is about fixing women.
Yeah.
It all needs to be on, we need to abolish the motherhood penalty. So we have to equalize the unpaid caring load that has to be shared, right? We've got to get rid of that motherhood penalty. Every workplace needs to be safe and women need to feel included. So men need to be allies, sticking up for us, intervening when they see bullying or harassment or discrimination. And even if it's not at that moment because it's uncomfortable, doing something later to follow it up, behaving like allies. And we absolutely 100% need women in force in every decision-making forum. And that means 40% women at every level of your organization that makes decisions. So for me, if we're going to spend time and energy in counting her in, which I want us to do, we have to change the environment because I can skill up every woman I know to negotiate a higher salary and to chase a better income and how to save and how to invest. If I take that woman who I have, you know, helped master money and put her back in the same environment, she will still experience the gender pay gap because it's the environment. So I don't want you to do anything, Emma, apart from if you hear an organization lauding the fact that they have implemented something that's teaching women to invest or teaching women to negotiate or anything like that, I would like you to go, no, that's not what this means. Mm. Not me. I don't need to change. You need to change. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I am pointing at leaders and men.
Yeah.
It is mostly women. We do have these biases as well, but we are not in enough positions of power to change this. It has to be leaders and men. So I want every action, every piece of energy we can muster focused on that. Once you solve that, the rest will come naturally.
Yeah.
I can then teach women who feel like they're not good with money that they are good with money and help them. But there's no alternative for them. Like individually, they still have to learn those things while we're waiting. You do have to play the hand you've been dealt the best you can, but it should not be the policy approach. Mm. It should not be the procedure approach or the systems approach from an organization or a government. We need them focused on fixing the system, not the women. So hopefully you're not as tired now. Hopefully you're not like, oh, gee, I've got a long time.
Actually, I saw a really beautiful analogy around that. So it's a goldfish that's swimming around in a goldfish bowl, and the goldfish bowl is, you know, filled up with chemicals, and funnily enough, the goldfish starts to feel unwell and isn't functioning particularly well. So you take the goldfish out and you put it in a bowl full of clean water, and the goldfish is happy and the goldfish gets better and the goldfish's life is good. And then you take it out of the clean water and you put it back in the previous one that hasn't been changed, you've done nothing to, and for some reason that revitalized goldfish starts to get sick again. And, you know, are we going to blame the goldfish or are we going to blame the pond that it's swimming around in?
Exactly. That is exactly what I'm talking about. Fix the pond.
That's
fish
it.
Fish is fine.
Yeah, the it's fish like, is fine.
It's a really beautiful analogy. But, yeah, so that is, I think, everything needs to be about clean the damn pond.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that's, we can keep, and I often use the analogy of it's the Hunger Games. I can teach women to be Katniss Everdeen. That's fine. But what we should be really doing is getting rid of the Hunger Games. Like That's what needs to happen, because if you don't, you're just going to keep putting Band-Aids on this thing.
Yeah.
It's an arterial bleed.
That's exactly it.
Tourniquet.
Band-Aid can only do so much.
We need everything to stop to get that right. And so that's why I just encourage everybody, men, women, just don't let leaders and organizations off the hook with anything that is about fixing the women. You might personally want that as a woman. You might want to learn to negotiate better. You might want to learn to save. Great. That cannot be the how we're going to fix this approach, because it's not going to work. You're going to end up with the dirty pond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before we wrap up for today, actually, let me check whether or not I had any other notes for things that I was going to ask you about. Oh, I think we've covered all of the bits. Have you got any final thoughts or anything that, you know, that you wanted to add to the conversation?
I think I feel really good after having that last little rant about fix the system, not the women. That is definitely what I would like our catch cry to be. And I realize how uncomfortable that is. And I realize that I am putting a lot of pressure back on men and leaders. I'm saying, not me, buddy, not my fault, your fault.
Yeah.
And they will potentially be offended, upset. Not me, I'm not like that. You know, I get it. I understand. But that's the system we're in, and we need you. We need you to do this. We can't do it. And I often point people back to, there's this great talk by Lieutenant General David Morrison, and he was in charge of the Defence Forces and at one point in time the head of the Diversity Council for Australia. And he talked about how Elizabeth Broderick, who was the Sex Discrimination Commissioner before Kate Jenkins, taught him about how all messages for this inclusion have to come from him as the white man in charge, you know, and it has to focus on capability. This is not about being morally right. This is not about it's the right thing to do. It's that everybody and everything will be better off. We will have more productivity. We will have a better society. We will be happier. All these things will improve and make your lives better. So making that case as a gain, it's not a net some zero game, like it's going to grow. So the more that we can equip men to feel comfortable and understanding that and have them spreading that message, the better our chances are of getting this happening quickly. So I think if you've heard a lot of what I've said and you're like, oh, stop blaming me, Lacey, that's where I'm coming from. It's not that we blame you. It's that I want men to be the ones leading the charge on this, because you have more chance of influencing the outcome than we do.
Yeah.
If your peers see it, it'll be better.
But the flip side of that is that it actually, you know, when we look at changing or challenging that sense of the maternal load and sharing that family load, there are men that I know who would love to be the ones who stay home with their children or, you exactly. know, go and pick them up. But my boss won't let me do that. And you've got a more understanding boss than I do. And, you know, exactly. the thing of, well, women are expected to go and be the ones who go and collect their child when their child's sick or go to school assemblies. I'd love to be able to do that. But this is actually working against me as well. So,
and it's bad for them. That's typecasting. Being typecast, whether you're being typecast as the homemaker or the breadwinner, it's not only is it a massive financial risk because if one party gets sick, you're screwed. Yeah. You both need to have that capability and that earning capacity. The emotional burden of that, like I really feel for men who have this, I must be the provider, stress hanging over them.
Yeah.
It is not necessary in modern days. There are some roles, yes, that require men to do them because they are physical. They are a vastly small proportion compared to what most, like if you're driving a desk, mate, anybody can do it.
That's so it.
that whole, you know, where we used to be and only a couple of decades ago, you know, that manufacturing transition and automation has only been in sort of, you know, the 80s, 90s, that sort of thing. Gosh, that's more than
10 years, but we'll just keep
going. Never mind, you know what I mean?
When you work out that 1980 is 50 years ago shortly, it's quite scary.
Yeah, that's terrifying. But that whole, yeah, I really, like I feel for it. And you're right, they get this discrimination against them. So my husband and I have had 5 years each. We've alternated a few times as the primary carer. And whenever he goes back to work, in the interviews, he's always asked, how come you at home with the kids?
Yeah.
Couldn't your wife do that?
Yeah.
And there are certainly, I've had male friends who took the paid parenting leave and their bosses swore them to secrecy, said, don't tell any of the other blokes. I don't want them taking this as well, even though it's a right.
Yeah.
So you're exactly right. Like, and it is the tagline, I think, of Annabelle Crabb's book, The Wife Drought, why women need wives and men need lives.
Yeah.
And that more equal sharing, everything's happier. Everything is better if we can feel more compassion for each other, we understand each other's points of view, and we're not typecast.
Yeah.
I just feel that is a huge risk for people. And so I really hope the men feel that there is a benefit for them and they get that option and that we see enough bosses changing their tune about this whole, oh, well, that's for the women to do, or, you know, you can't take that leave, or what are you going home to pick up sick little Johnny from school for? Yeah. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The more we can change that, the better we're all going to be off.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for your time today. An hour has absolutely flown by and I very much enjoyed the soapboxing. So thank you. And it was short notice. So I really appreciate all your time and all your thoughts and energy for today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it too. Thanks for letting me get on my soapbox. You can tell I like a good rant every now and then. But I really applaud you for tackling this topic because it's such a nuanced one and there's so much in there to unpack.
Yeah.
So I'll be very interested to hear what listeners think.
Me too. Bab. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for today's episode of A Hidden World of Women, a podcast brought to you by Women's Health and Wellbeing Services. For more information on the services we offer, head to whws.org.au or Women's Health and Wellbeing Services on YouTube and social media. Looking forward to the next episode where we uncover the hidden world of women.